James McGrath.
Andy Gaunt, how are you?
Good to see you. Look at you, up, bright and early, sparky, ready to face the day. It's incredible.
Yeah, you know what? It's amazing what I can do without coffee, actually. I haven't had any yet. But, I'm excited about this week's pod. We're gonna mix it up a little bit.
Well, that's it. We have got a special guest, and I wonder if that's perhaps why you're up as early as you are and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed the way you are, because you're excited about this very special guest we have tonight.
I think you're talking about yourself, to be honest, considering it's 5 a.m. for me, but you were phoning me much earlier than 5 o'clock to make sure that I was out of bed and that I was ready. I know you're excited for today. I mean, I am, but I know you are.
You got some clues? You know who this is? It's someone from the automotive world.
It's quite a big name, isn't it? It's Joey from Friends.
It's not Joey from Friends. Do you know what? He's sitting there on the line patiently. I need to bring him in. I feel like I'm hosting an episode of Smartless here. All right, so I've got to say, you're right. I am super excited about this guest. And in fact, I'm actually a little bit nervous because in the automotive journalism world, there are a few better than this man. There are a few whose content is as beautifully produced, few who can so clearly articulate the feeling behind the wheel of a car that most of us will never experience. And he has this poeticism to his voice. And even my wife, Kath, will watch his videos because she reckons he sounds like Kevin MacLeod. This guy's a mad keen cyclist. He looks as fit as a fiddle. And he has some of the best sideburns I've seen since Luke Perry in Beverly Hills 90210. I'm going to say it up front. This is a big fanboy moment for me, James. It's the one, it's the only, Henry Catchpole.
No way.
Henry, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I feel like I now ought to say sort of how you doing or something. I'm so sorry I'm not Joey from Friends. It's gonna be, Matt LeBlanc would be much better. Everyone's now very disappointed.
I can't believe you actually went with the Top Gear presenter of all the people you could have thrown in there.
You know what? Maybe it's just because I was hoping for Joey from Friends. No, I'm joking. Henry Catchpole. Henry, welcome.
I'm definitely more Chandler anyway, so.
Fair enough. Maybe me too. Henry, welcome to the pod. I don't know how much you know about Curb and Canyon, but pretty Thank much you. Every episode, we're often sort of talking about you, referring to you, and it's just incredible that we got you on the pod. I'm blown away, absolutely blown away.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be doing this. It's great. any excuse to chat Porsches, so yeah.
That's so good to hear, because as a few of my friends have somewhat unkindly asked, how the hell did we get you to agree to come on the pod?
You sent me a message on Instagram, and I replied, and that's, you know, that's the way we do it, isn't it? It's kind of, I try and reply to most messages on Instagram one way or another, and don't flood me with them, because it takes me a while, generally, as you know, but try and get around to it.
Yeah, and you were exceedingly nice, exceedingly nice. Henry, for those who don't know, and there wouldn't be many, I assume, who is Henry Catchpole?
Henry Catchpole is a tall British motoring journalist.
Wait, there are two of us?
A lot of coffee. I'm drinking my coffee now. Actually, the only reason we might get interrupted is because I've got a coffee delivery coming. I'm used to deliver it at some point, so I have no control of that. So if we have to pause, it's for good reason, because there is good coffee coming from.
That's totally cool.
So yeah, cast iron coffee roasters actually. So I'm on Kelowna at the moment, but yeah. Anyway, I digress. I am 41 years old. And I've been doing this for the best part of 20 years now. And by this, I mean being a motoring journalist. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Good Lord.
I like cycling as well. Running. Yeah.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff.
Amazing. Henry, take me back to those early days, those early journalism days. Was Evo the beginning? Does it go back further than that? How did it all start for you?
So it really started, it sort of started with Evo in some ways. I bought car magazines before that sort of stuff. My parents were into cars very much. They met through MGs way back in the 60s. And I suppose I'd always loved cars, always watched Formula One, that sort of thing. But it was when Evo came out as a magazine that my best friend at school, Bruce, his father, bought the first issue of Evo, partly because he was thinking about buying a Maserati 3200. Tremilliduecente, that sounds much better. And so he bought the first issue. Bruce nicked it off him. I nicked it off Bruce. And I read it. And I just thought, this is brilliant. And I'd read sort of Performance Car before that, so I knew some of the names and things. But there was something about Evo and the kind of, I'd say seriousness, because they didn't take it too seriously, but it was beautifully written and fantastic photography. And I just thought, this is what I want to do. You know, I wasn't, everybody dreams of being a driver or being a Formula One driver, a rally driver or whatever, but I hadn't been put in a cart at the age of two. I clearly, you know, I was too tall for single seaters even by that point anyway. So, I loved writing, and I thought, this is absolutely what I want to do. So it sort of started with Evo. Obviously, I didn't go straight from school into it. There was various sort of competitions you could enter. Weirdly, at the time, sort of the Daily Telegraph had one for young motoring writers, which seemed awfully specific sort of when you look at it now. It's sort of, it's that point where you think, am I in the Truman Show? Because, you know, why on earth would somebody run a competition specifically for young motoring writers? That's, you know, that's bizarre. But
right.
Entered that, and I think I got shortlisted or something like that. Anyway, I milked that for all it was worth and managed to get work experience through that, and did a week with Evo while I was at university, and then a week with Autocar. But Evo is really where I wanted to be. It just kind of felt like home. I mean, I didn't really do much during that first week. I think the most exciting car I went in was a Citroen C5, probably a diesel, on the run to Tesco at lunchtime. But yeah, it was just nice. Fantastic. I did make myself the motoring editor of the student rag up at St Andrews, right. University. It's called The Saint, imaginatively. And yeah, I don't know sort of if they really wanted a motoring journalist in their pages.
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
That 12 readers were really excited about it, though.
Well, yeah, exactly. And there's I've probably told it before, but there's I have the back page of it, where the top line of it for the sports section is Jonathan Palmer reviews the football season or something like that, and then underneath it, Henry Catchpole reviews the new F1 season, which I always thought was quite amusing.
It's pretty good.
But yeah, other than that, it basically meant I could just blag press passes into the local race circuit sort of up there and go along and stand inside the fence and, well, not have to pay for a ticket. That was the main thing, given I was a poor student. So and then came out of university, emailed Evo sort of, I didn't. I popped in to see Evo once I came out, and I had my sort of portfolio of two bits and bobs I'd written and sort of practiced writing the odd column and obviously whatever I'd written for The Saint, which was probably complete rubbish. But I popped into the offices because I was driving up the M1 in my Mini, and in my mind, the offices weren't that far off the M1. They're actually quite a way away. And the Evo had just been sort of, it was in a bit of a transition period, and I just sort of lucked in. It was just after deadline, so everyone was quite sort of relaxed and happy. And they said, oh yeah, we're a bit thin on the ground at the moment, because a couple of people had gone, I think Dickie Meaden had just gone freelance, and there was a sort of Jethro had sort of stepped up, and so there was that position for a lowly dog's body who could make tea and coffee, neither of which I drank at the time actually, but I made an awful lot of them, because that was about the most useful thing I could do.
Glamorous. And so you basically stalked your way into your job.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it's kind of, you know.
You thought, I'm just going to go and hunt these guys down and make them give me a job.
I like to think of it as sort of showing initiative and tenacity. But if you want to say stalked, that's, you know, that's your lookout, James. That's absolutely fine. It's all a matter of perception.
I guess. Fruit.
I just googled Henry Catchpole plus The Saint. I can't find any of your old works, unfortunately. So.
Oh, good. Excellent. Yeah, it was pre-internet, so, well, sort of.
And so when you're at Evo, the thing that always strikes me about that cohort of writers is that clearly you can all steer pretty bloody well as write really well. Is there equal parts training of how to craft a beautiful narrative and how to put a car into oversteer and pose it for the camera at speed?
I wouldn't say there's really any training at all as such. It was sort of quite a strange thing. You definitely had to go and ask for feedback on your writing. And in terms of the driving, I subsequently discovered, I think I was probably not going to last very long there, because I all thought I drove far too slowly. Most of which was because I had crashed a car and work experience at Autocar, and therefore thought that really sort of, you know, I'd somehow managed to get around that and still potentially have a career in this. And so the last thing I wanted to do, so I erred on the side of caution, which was then probably the wrong thing to do. But anyway, here we are today. So yeah, it's a lot of it's just sort of, it's a bit of practice, because you end up at circuits, obviously, and if you can sort of blag a bit of time at the end of the day and stuff like that. And it's a case of being, you've got to know when to take the risks to learn, I suppose, because like I just said, you know, they want to know they've got a safe pair of hands initially, because you're not going to be sent out to go and, oh, here's a, you know, latest GT3. Could you just go and do the cornering shots over there? Because we need a couple. It's not going to happen, which is absolutely brilliant, because that's not what I would have wanted to happen, to be honest. You know, you want that proper apprenticeship. And I was very lucky that I kind of had that.
Bit of pressure.
Yeah, exactly. And so Bedford Autodrome was just around the corner. That was our sort of home circuit. And they were very good to me as well. And sort of sometimes in the evening, I'd go and be able to practice down there a couple of times. And the rest of it, yeah, I sat next to Jethro and Dickie and John. As you say, they were absolute heroes to me, and are incredibly good drivers. I mean, to sit next to them and be able to watch them jump from one car to another, sort of, because you have these big group tests, and you know, it's like, it's just you've got very limited time, so you've probably got, you know, two or three laps in each car sometimes to extract a lap time that's good enough. And they were literally just one to the other, and I would do all the timing equipment at the time, because again, it's another job that nobody really wants to do, because it's all a bit sort of, you know, faffy and terrible old PC laptop that was a bit recalcitrant and stuff like that. So I would do that and stick all the aerials on and make sure it was all working. And then obviously to check that it was still working, we always did our figuring two up. So I got to sit there, and luckily I'm not somebody that gets sick in cars. So you get to, and if you know what you're looking for to some extent, and you have an appreciation of driving, and you're just a sponge at that point, you've got an absolute front row seat to see how to do it all. And I've always been a bit of a case of kind of, you know, monkey see, monkey do. I like that element of it. If I've seen somebody else, you know, healing and towing, braking, doing whatever it is sort of in a car, and understanding how all these different cars work, for me that was absolutely brilliant, because you kind of sort of store away all this information, and that definitely helped me a huge amount. That and playing would have been GT3 or GT4 possibly, Gran Turismo 4.
Oh, of course.
We had a rig in the office. Right. Yeah, we had a rig in the office with a big old Sony television screen, flat screen business, and a Recaro seat and some scaffolding and stuff like that. And that was brilliant, because I had no friends up there at the time. So I was just living out of, you know, B&Bs or a sort of, you know, room in some random person's house that I was paying for. So I had nothing to do in the evenings other than sit there and play on this Sony PlayStation.
You said like quite the catch back in those days, Henry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it really was.
That takes me back to my early days in London. I was more of a Project Gotham guy on the Xbox, but I had many a lonely Friday night with a takeaway pizza in my flat in Chiswick playing racing games.
And it's what turned us into the nice rounded people we are today.
exactly.
For me, it was Daytona down at the local Time Zone arcade. Daytona and Sega Rally were the two.
You do it differently in Australia, though. We all know that.
Well, it's because we're upside down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Henry, tell me about that transition from, you know, automotive journalist, the written word, into the video space, into the content space, because it seems as though, you know, for a lot of motoring journos, that's a transition that's perhaps a tough one to make, where they don't necessarily feel comfortable stepping in front of the camera. How did you find that? And did you deliberately set about, you've got quite a unique style, did you deliberately set about cultivating that, or was it just just sort of by osmosis, it just happened?
It wasn't, I mean, when I started out, there was no sort of, there was an Evo website, but we didn't really do much on it, to be honest, at all, even sort of the written stuff. And gradually that came in. And then there was no thought of doing video at all. There was Top Gear in the UK, but that was just something completely different. Obviously, Clarkson came from a magazine background with some of the guys that I was working with at Evo. But it just hadn't crossed my mind at all. But as it sort of came along, some guys started sort of dabbling in it, I suppose. And then there was that whole period when some of the guys went off and set up Drives Republic, and there was a bit of sort of video stuff going on, and then the iPad came out, and there was really a feeling at the time, sort of the economic troubles as well, and magazines were, it looked like they were dying. Basically, everybody was predicting the end of magazines, and the iPad was going to take over, and this whole digital media and YouTube comes out. And it just, I was sitting there as a relatively young motoring journalist thinking, right, how am I going to keep doing this? So video might have to be something that I look at doing. And I'd always loved the photography side of things as well. I loved taking photos, and I enjoyed working with all the fantastic photographers at Evo. So I sort of, I liked the visual side of it, and the fact that a magazine is kind of, putting a magazine feature together is a bit like putting a video together in terms of, I think anyway, if you're doing it well, you work with a photographer to get the photos, they're going to represent the words, and vice versa, you might get an amazing photo and then weave that into how you tell the story. So you think, well, that's going to be a great opener. So you write it around the photo. So you have this lovely blend of image and word. And so actually, once I got my head around that, and I sort of began looking at generally sort of other outside the automotive space, God, that sounds very poncy, isn't it? But, skiing or cycling or mountain biking or stuff like that, and they produce really, really beautiful videos. And there's nobody really doing that with cars sort of on the outside of Top Gear. And I thought, well, perhaps we could do that and sort of and produce films that are where I am just an incidental part of it because I have to be in it and review the car or whatever, but make it much more about scenery and stuff, so it's not just me. And I went on Dennis Publishing set up some sort of course for people that were looking at getting into, or they're promoting people to do more video. And I went along to that, and I don't think I took it terribly seriously, but I actually realised that was probably the way to do it and just be sort of confident with it. If you're reticent about it, it doesn't work. Mm. And the first few times on camera, you watch it back and you go, oh, that's terrible. And then you realise that you have to be sort of 150% of yourself.
Yes.
Because I'm a fairly quiet, mumbling sort of person. I might look at it on camera anyway, but that's me at 150%. And I realize I'm still relatively quietly spoken. So
that's the feedback we had about you.
and I don't script stuff really at all, because that doesn't work for me. I think that's something that you have to, you know, the idea of learning lines, you just then stumble over them. So just be as natural as possible, I suppose, and talk about what you see and feel and all that. So, I've enjoyed it. I still find it slightly awkward seeing myself on screen, but I've got used to it, I suppose, just because I have to do it every day, and you do get used to it. And I look at it, I see myself on screen, and it's weird, I don't almost see it as me. I've managed to somehow detach myself, so I don't feel quite so awkward about it. But there we go, luckily it seems to have worked and people like watching it, so.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny that, isn't it? Because I'll sometimes be cutting one of my videos and my wife will come in and there I am. And she'll just say, "You're just watching yourself again." I'm like, "No, it's not. I'm not sitting here super impressed by how amazing I am. I have to. Someone has to cut it, and it's got to be me, unfortunately." So, yeah, I sit there looking at myself all the time, and she just thinks I'm incredibly nuts, I think. But it is true. You do. It's funny what you say about having to be this kind of amplified version of yourself, because. Yeah, I know with even with the pod with James, when we're just kind of talking normally, the way that comes across on the pod can be a little bit low energy. It doesn't quite deliver in the same way. So you do, everything's got to be amplified.
Yeah, it's a funny old business, isn't it? But there we go.
Do you ever, are there videos, particularly your early ones, that you look back on and think, oh God, what was I thinking there? Or what was the edit decision we made there that didn't land?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Lots. Thankfully, they've generally sort of disappeared off into the depths of YouTube and they're quite hard to find. I've made that mistake before by pointing ones
we'll
out. People
it.
Have gone
we'll
out.
Find
yeah,
it.
Exactly. And it's generally, I mean, I listen back to stuff like VoiceOver that you sort of think, God, I sounded so sort of, I don't know, either worthy or just slightly disinterested at the time. And again, you have to amp it up and get better. I'm still not great at it, but in terms of voiceover. But yeah, there's certain things as well. Like just, I realized I've never been a sort of one for male grooming and sort of having my hair cut twice a week or anything like that.
Twice a week?
But whatever it is, I don't know what people do.
Have you been telling him about my routine, James?
Oh my God. You can see how perfectly groomed Andy's quiff is.
And I was basically always a bit dishevelled and, you know, going through a hedge backwards sort of thing. But I realised again that I couldn't appear on camera totally dishevelled and sort of go, oh, it's fine, it doesn't matter, I'm just myself, because then you become a distraction for the people watching. If people are watching and commenting on kind of, you could have brushed your hair this morning, or kind of, you know, why didn't you shave that half of your face, or whatever it was, then yeah. They're not looking at the car, and it's become, you've defeated the point of making the video, and you've gone to all that effort, and all people are doing is yeah, looking at not the car, which is not right.
So, no.
There you go. Yeah.
Misses the point, doesn't it? I think, James, how many videos of the week has Henry had? At least two, right?
Yeah, definitely. And if it was up to you, we wouldn't have anyone else with video of the week. This week from my Henry collection.
Look, that may or may not be true.
Absolutely true.
Well, thank you.
It's mostly true. But so that level of production that goes into what you do, the cinematography and the like, it's epic.
It really is next level.
You know, the drone work. In fact, James sent me a message the other day about one of your videos, and he used a rather unkind word, because he's just like, this. Yeah, this stuff's just so good. And so my question is, when you're doing that and you're shooting drive-bys, we get to see this video where it looks like you're effortlessly driving through the Black Forest or somewhere, but clearly you're having to drive past the camera, stop, turn around, come back the other way. Do you get that opportunity to just enjoy the car, or is it, you know, so much start, stop, get the shot and all that sort of stuff? How do you balance those things?
Yeah, it's you have to make sure that you get the chance to enjoy the car, or at least test the car and find out what it's about, which obviously you're doing sort of all the time when you're doing the shots. But equally, as you say, as you know, there's an awful lot to think about to get the shots and sort of and pick the right piece of road in the first place. That helps enormously sort of, but yeah, you're looking for your turnaround spots. What sort of shot is the cameraman about to do? Are you going the right speed? Are you doing yada, 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 yada? Is the car doing the right thing in the corner, et cetera, et cetera? So yes, you're thinking about an awful lot of other things other than just what is this car like for a lot of the time And a lot of it, it was always the same with photography, though. You know, you the best drive on even something like Evo Car of the Year was often to and from the hotel at the beginning and the end of the day. And that was the really, really fun bit where you're not thinking about anything else other than just driving the car. But yeah, I mean, you do still get fantastic kind of moments just to enjoy the car. And I've always said to people, I think it's kind of, it's nothing like as glamorous as it looks. And that's part of my job, is obviously to make everything look as lovely as possible, because it's not what people want to see really otherwise. But so it's not as glamorous as it looks, but equally the highs are even higher than I can probably convey on film, because you get those moments that are just absolutely absolutely fantastic. So yeah, it's you definitely still get the chance to drive the cars and enjoy them.
That's actually so good to hear, because I wondered about that. So you've got, you know, you think about some of the cars you've driven, 911 GT1, Singer, Gunther Works, Speedster, GT4 RS, Workshop 5001, all of them, right? The whole gamut. And then you've got access to these sort of luminary figures like Andy Preuninger, Jean-Pierre Nicolas, like all these moments where, you know, the average Joe like me and James here, we're not going to get to be able to do that. And do you still have those pinch yourself moments?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Because yeah, and I think the moment you don't, you probably stop doing the job. Because
yeah,
you know, there's absolutely, and I love finding new roads and yeah, it's just, I still love cars. You know, I love driving. That's what, you know, gives me the biggest kick. It's not the value of the car or anything like this. It is how it makes me feel when I'm driving it, and driving, you know, quickly, slowly, whatever. Just that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. So I still look forward to that, and the same meeting the people, that's always fascinating. And I can't quite believe some of the people I have been able to meet through the job. I wouldn't say it's the best bit, because I still love the cars, but it's something I probably didn't even really think about when I started doing the job, that I get to meet these people. So yeah.
Have you met Joey from Friends?
No, I haven't actually. No, it's kind of, oh, no, we've never been in the same room together. Oh, conspiracy theory.
Not. I'm sure Henry was probably pretty nervous about meeting us today.
Of course, absolutely. Yeah.
Joey from Friends. So, Henry, obviously you drive everything, right? And so James and I, obviously our podcast is very, let's say, Porsche centric. You know, obviously the cars you drive all the big hitters from all the big brands, as well as, you know, some of the hot hatches, all these things. And so every brand has its place in this sort of automotive universe, let's say, and all of them have their brilliant things and their not so brilliant things. Can you talk about what you think makes Porsche so special in the pantheon of aspirational automakers? What perhaps separates it?
I think it is, it's probably down to the engineering, isn't it, really? The racing element, which is undoubtedly important, because that inspires people, I think, sort of, you know, you can't help but sort of, you know, you see the Grelle 911, or you get sort of, you know, wrapped up in the history and watching a 917 or all these stories behind it.
Yeah.
And then for me, it's just, it comes back to the driving, really, at the end of the day. It's all that stuff. But at the heart of it, what makes me love Porsches is the way they drive. It's something that I didn't really get. I mean, growing up, you know, all the things I've just mentioned apply to Ferrari too. let's face it, and growing up, I loved Ferrari.
Yeah.
They were red. My favourite colour was red. That was my favourite. I have an entire, you know, one, two sort of massive great storage tubs full of all my Ferrari models that I collected when I grew up. That was the brand. It was more glamorous. They kind of looked not with this slightly funky shape of a 911 that you kind of sort of... They look more glamorous. But you drive a Porsche and you drive one for the first time. And I did it. Well, everybody else does as well with, you know, Evo Car of the Year and Porsche winning all those times, you know, before I was joined the magazine. You said, really? It's a Porsche again? Really? Why? Kind of, you know, surely there's a Lamborghini over there. Kind of like, why did that not win? And you kind of, and then you drive it and you feel that gear shift and you feel that steering, you feel the way that, you know, in the case of a 911, that weight distribution. And then you drive it a bit more and then you start sliding around and sort of, I'm saying there are other cars that do it, but the way that a Porsche over the limit seems to keep gripping and just feels so controllable when you slide one. And that feeling is just addictive. And I think that's, you know, the way they drive is, you know, fast or slow, certainly the best ones, where they sound, it's that feeling when you're behind the wheel, that is what makes people, I think, so enthusiastic and loyal to them. And yeah, there's nothing else quite like it.
Do you think as well that the sort of culture around them, and there's a level of exclusivity that perhaps is not at the level of something like Ferrari or Lamborghini, where they really are reserved for the very lucky few, whereas you can get into a, you know, a Gen 1 Boxster, or you can get into a 944 or one of these older cars, have a ripping good time in them, and you're in, you're part of the gang, you're part of the community.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, it's slightly depressing watching the prices of all sorts, sort of particularly 911s going north. But as you say, there are still ones out there that you can get into for, thankfully, not too much money. And yeah, it is different to other things out there. And while I'll never, you look at something like a Bugatti, and it's not going to happen. You know, unless my numbers come up.
No,
but I'm not going to have even the chance to own one. But you say it's that thing of these, they feel within reach somehow. And that sort of, as you go through life, there are all those sort of cars. I remember like when the Lotus Elise came out, and loving it because it was at a price point where even at the age I was, I could think, oh yeah, one day that might be attainable. And like you say, yeah, so it's the same with, mm-hmm. with Porsche. Oh, hang on. Right, here we go.
Coffee?
Live coffee delivery.
Oh, this is great.
Live coffee. Where?
Yeah, awesome.
Here we go.
Get it.
Bear with me. There we go.
To the audience, I want to say this is really exciting that we're seeing Henry take delivery of this coffee, but actually what I'm looking at is a blank grey wall and Henry's vanished. There's movement, though, on the wall. Great shadows, hard, perhaps?
Here we go.
It's back.
Coffee. Oh. Should we do a live unboxing? Let's do a live unboxing.
Let's do it.
So this is. So I had some Kelowna this morning from my local ad office, and this is from Cast Iron, which is actually down by Goodwood. So anyone that goes to Goodwood Festival of Speed or the Revival or something, they're just around the corner. So yeah, it's from Honduras.
Noted. This episode of Curb and Canyon is brought to you by Cast Iron Coffee.
which is slightly different from James's normal. What do you use in the Mr. Fusion coffee maker, James? It's just Nescafe, International Roast. What are we talking?
We call it Minnesota Brown.
Love it. Do you know what? Talking about those cheaper cars, Henry, do you think, are we too obsessed with the GT stuff? You know, for the average git, should we all just be aspiring to drive, you know, base Carreras or Carrera Ts? Are they on the road actually a better proposition in some ways?
No. to put it bluntly.
Sorry, Base Carrara owners.
That I would love to be able to sit here and say that, you know, it's not the case, but GT stuff is irritatingly very, very, very good. That is not to say that, you know, it's that kind of.
So can our clickbait headline be, Henry Catchpole says Base Carrera rubbish.
No, it can't be. No, because here's the point. It's a very quick story about we at Evo had the dying days of the 997. There was a white cabriolet manual on little wheels with a red interior. It was about the most un-Evo sort of spec of 911 that you could possibly get, and it stayed with us for quite some time, I think because the press office actually forgot about it, and we loved it. We absolutely, it was just one of those things, you know, little wheels, manual gearbox, open door, it was fantastic. So would we have, you know, given the choice, if you've been sitting next to a GT3 in the car park, can I hand on heart say I wouldn't have gone and driven the GT3? No, but did we all absolutely love that white cab? Yes, yeah, we did. It was great. So it's I'd love to be able to hear and say that. So, you don't really need a GT3, but it's you know, 997, you know, Gen 2, 3.8. No, it's not really all that kind of, you know, just as well off with the bait. No, it's not true, but there is something to be enjoyed. But and I think that's kind of the lovely thing is, like you say, you get these cars and everybody starts sort of tweaking their cars with the aim of making them perhaps a little bit more like a GT3, or you get a bit, you know, do this, do that. And you don't have to have a GT3. I suppose that's the other way of looking at it, isn't it? Sort of to make it a more positive spin on it. So, yeah, there we go.
Just ask James. All you need is stripes, right, James?
I was going to say stripes and a spoiler on the back. I don't know what you guys are talking about. I have never tried to make any of my cars look like a GT3.
The king of the mods. Henry, do you think you perhaps maybe have a little bit more inside line than the rest of us do? Is Porsche heading in the right direction? Are they keeping on doing the right sort of stuff that as enthusiasts we want to see from them?
I think they generally are. I think it's a very difficult world generally that we're living in terms of the automotive sense. I mean, the fact that they still produce manual GT3s with naturally aspirated engines, you know, they haven't gone chasing the big horsepower with GT3. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you look at the new naturally aspirated 4-litre engine in GT4,
yep.
Or even the GTS 4-litre. You know, they're doing this right. Yeah, they're absolutely doing this right to that extent. And you drive stuff like the Taycan. I did a film with Taycan GTS not long ago, and it there's an awful lot of sort of it seems to be so polarizing, the whole EV thing, and I get it. You know, I'm not about to sit here and say that I suddenly love EVs because it's going to keep me in a job or something like that. You know, I'm terrified of the fact when they all become EVs, but having said that, driving Taycan GTS, it gives me some sort of hope because and it didn't initially. I drove, you know, Taycan Turbo S on the launch, did not like it at all. It was just seemed to be doing that standard EV thing. All the things I'd hoped we would get from Porsche didn't seem to be there. It just seemed to be a rocket ship in a straight line, bit kind of funky in the corners, and you know, it could accelerate faster than it stopped, which is not really a nice thing. And then eventually I drove the rear-wheel drive version and drove GTS, and all those sort of Porsche things came back in again. And the lovely steering feel and the balance and it just all the tactility in the car made up for a lot of the fact, and they backed off the, you know, things like having a really nicely progressive throttle, so you didn't get all that oomph from the EV drivetrain straight away. You could meter it out on a decent road. So they put all that Porsche know-how back into it, which gives me hope for when they sort of go full EV for a sports car. I think by and large it's a tricky market, and I think Porsche are, they're not going to get it right all the time, but they haven't in the past either. And so by and large, yeah.
You know, that gives me a lot of hope, because I drove the Taycan Turbo and you know, was blown away by the power, but at the same time I felt like the car had, you know, sort of been delivered to me without a soul. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel the Teslas are very, very much that way as well. And I guess, you know, you think about digital technology and you think about, you know, that whole sort of realm, you start thinking about, you know, black and white, on or off, binary, one and zero. But to hear that they can take an electric drivetrain like that and start to put the Porsche aspects of it back into the car, which they may have missed intentionally or not, you know, the first time round. That's fantastic, because that's one of the things that I really love about the petrol powered cars, is just that sort of feeling that you need to work with the machine to get the best out of it. You know, you're there as part of the experience. You're not just along for the ride. You know, you're not just a passenger. You're really part of that particular drive in that particular moment, and making every single part of the experience happen. You are a central part of that. The driver is a part of that.
Yeah. And I think the thing that is important to remember in all of that is that when you drive a 911, yes, having the flat six is a huge part of it, but so much of what we'll love about a 911 is not to do with the flat six, or at least sort of not to do with necessarily the sound it makes or the way it propels us up the road. It's, you know, it's position in the car, it's the steering feel that we'll talk about, it's the the braking, the way the chassis moves, the sort of all those other things which, you know, have to be amplified even more in an electric car for sure. But a big part of what makes us love a driver's car is still there in an EV. Yeah, we don't get the sound. I'm not about to say that. And like I say, it sounds like I'm being a huge sort of EV fanboy or something like that, which I recognise the problems, but there has to be some sort of hope in there for these things. And I think the GTS shows that it can be done.
Yeah, there's got to be a pathway forward, doesn't there?
Yeah.
Porsche, obviously, they listen to our pod every week. Yeah. They're big fans of it. if you could take the opportunity to maybe say, give them some some constructive feedback, what could they be doing differently, do you think?
So it was something I'd thought about for a while is I haven't driven the latest T yet. Hopefully we'll do it at some point. But I think with the whole T thing, I'd certainly thought with the previous ones, it would be great if the T could be that proper, but yes, cheaper, and make it absolutely sort of, you know, you can only get it with a manual box. Actually, no, you could have PDK with it. Fair enough. That's, you have that option in there, because I know not everybody can have a manual, so that seems, you know, wrong to kind of, but fun. So you get your choice of gearbox, but it's on small wheels. You don't get sort of, you know, it's a, they say this is the absolute driver's spec. If you want a Porsche 911 because you'd want to drive it, that's just what you want it for. You know, you give it the you know, manual aircon or whatever, or sort of, you know, take a screen away, just strip it right back. And you cannot spec it up, because obviously at the moment with a T you can spec it up to be something bigger and whatever else. You know, you can't run brakes on it, you can't do any of this stuff. It's the base model, so it's not a cheaper way into, you kind of almost make it sort of, I'll say uncomfortable enough, but you know what I mean, sort of unattractive enough to the casual Porsche buyer that's going to walk in, that's not going to go for the truck. So it just appeals to that, make it the absolute grassroots 911 for people that want one for driving. That would be my plea to them, I think.
Well, you heard it here first, Porsche. But you know, it's funny because I have that conversation with friends all the time, and I reckon 60 to 70% of the teas that come up for sale in the Australian market, at least on the secondhand market, I'm talking, you know, most of them are spec'd up, PDK, sunroof, rear seats, like everything. You know, it's basically, it goes back to being a Carrera S, but it's got a, you know, quasi special badge on it. And that's fine. I mean, I don't begrudge anybody their spec choices on any car that they order. And you have, really.
Absolutely.
You want to jump in the sea, don't you? You see,
but I would never say it publicly.
You mutter it quietly, sort of vaguely within hearing distance. What was that? Did you say something? No. Just cough. Something in the throat, back of the throat. Oh, nightmare.
Yeah, but look, we all do it, right? But at the end of the day, like I say, everyone's entitled to their spec choices. But when the occasional one comes up where it's spec with no rear seats and no sunroof and it's manual, I think, yeah, that person got it right. Henry, tell me, you've driven some of these amazing air-cooled cars as well as the modern stuff. And how do those two experiences differ? And perhaps not just in purely subjective terms, but even just the feel you get from, say, an air-cooled 911 versus, you know, some of the more modern stuff.
Oh, blimey. I suppose it's inevitably rawer with the air-cooled stuff. I suppose it's just that a bit rawer is the kind of, if you were going to sum it up in something, that's your real sort of takeaway. But there is, because the trouble is there's so many other things going on as well that it's sometimes hard to take the two things sort of apart, because there's that clear delineation from sort of, there was such a step change with 996 onwards, that to just sort of split into, you know, air cooled and kettles is kind of tricky in a way. But
do you think it's you look for, because I've sort of driven both. Obviously, my car's a 964. I owned a GT4 for a little while. And I always found that there were things to love in each experience that were sometimes similar but sometimes different, right? And in the 964, for example, when you're on it in the twisties, you're moving every part of your body. Both arms are involved. Both feet are dancing. You know, my friend Gerard talks about it's like playing you're doing the bongo dance. Versus in the GT4 where you've got rev matching and it's not a better or worse experience, because then you're excited about the way it sounds, the turn in, all those different things, and it's just a different experience that's equally as captivating in its own way.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, isn't it? It's funny how perceptions change over time as well, obviously, because the further we get away from those early water-cooled cars, you know, the 996s, the more you jump back into one of those now, and kind of a lot of what you're saying about the air-cooled experience, actually now we find in that, and you think, oh, this car's moving around a lot more, and it's kind of, you know, it's how small it is, and kind of, so all that stuff is actually just migrating further up the food chain in terms of just pure an age factor, and the fact that cars have got sort of bigger over age. So yeah, I think there's all sorts of that are great. You know, shot isn't there of all the different 911s over the years with the sort of the rears of them or whatever that they produce, and it's just that you can see it right there, and the further ones go back down the line, it inevitably changes over time.
Right.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's probably less about air cooled v water cooled, and not that I'm trying to perpetuate those sort of delineations and lines that we sometimes draw in the sand. But as you say, I remember driving, I had a 991 for a period, and getting out of that car and driving my friend's 996 and thinking, this car feels perfection. It's It's the perfect size. It's so nimble, so agile, but has just that enough level of modernity in the drive. And James, you've gone from 991 to 996.
Yeah.
And that car was supposed to be a project car. And look at you. You can't get rid of it.
I know. Just, that's right. Every time I get into it, I'm like, yeah, this is my car. I love it.
Yeah.
Henry, the drives you've had, if we said Porsches that we've seen in your films, is there one that stands out? Is there one where you think that was epic?
I mean, I'm so lucky because there have been so many and so many different experiences. Like I say, I go back to the Boxster GTS on Mallorca, which just was, there was something very special about that car, which again, I think came back to some of the, attainable nature of that. You're driving around thinking, yeah, one day maybe this could be sort of,
yeah.
But it was, I mean, such spectacular roads, and we were up from, you know, well before dawn till long after sunset, and sort of, you know, it's just, and it was with doing that job with, you know, good friends as well, sort of Sam Riley and Dean Smith, and sort of you're there and enjoying just the whole experience of that. I had numerous drives that obviously never on camera. Workshop 5001, that car, I just, there was something about that I absolutely loved.
I hope you'd say that. Oh, I love that.
It's just such a cool car, and so many people don't really know about Workshop 5001. But it's, yeah, I don't know, just, I know it was very expensive, and I think Marlon got a lot of sort of flack in the comments about that because it was such an expensive car. We went with a headline, which is probably a bit sort of wrong in a way, but they're all those things are cheaply expensive. And but it was, I remember seeing it at it was at the Quail the week before, and yep, all the amazing stuff that's there, and Tatton Safari kind of stuff there. But it's just this little kind of, you know, unobtrusive almost car, sort of with no great big wings and quite an unassuming colour and stuff like that. It was, but the sound of it, unbelievable. So yeah, I have very fond memories of that car, driving, say, some of the Tuthill rally cars, because I'm a rally boy at heart, and I love rally cars. So that kind of always driving the RGT, and nothing makes me happier than finding another 906 or 997 rally car on YouTube and some onboard footage. So the chance to play it doing that for a bit was a lot of fun. And in terms of films, weirdly, I think it's probably the one that I'm probably proudest of was not sort of specifically Porsche, but also was the Manuals Matter film that I did.
Classic.
I keep thinking if I can try and do something like that again for Haggerty, so I might have to try and try and do it. And then recently, on Haggerty, we did the GT4 RS again out in the States, which was so much fun, sort of, and meeting Lee Keane for the first time, never met him before, and
right,
a great bunch of guys, and all the other cars that were there on the Smokies GT was great. What a car park that was. But I think, yeah, Manuals Matter was special just because it felt like a different thing and a bit of a line in the sand, and nobody else had sort of made a film like that. So, yeah, that was good.
I love that. I actually just watched it earlier, and, you know, the little sequence with the coffee and the eyeball and all that stuff, it's so well done. And the way you explain it is, it's just terrific. It's hard to articulate what a manual gearbox brings to the experience. And not just because it's obviously not as quick as a PDK or something similar, but to explain what it actually adds to it, I think you did such a great job. So, yeah, I'm glad that some of the films you mentioned are certainly some of my favourites. Henry, if we said, we'll finish this up in a sec, if we said day after tomorrow, you can never drive another great road and never drive another Porsche, but tomorrow you can drive any Porsche on any road anywhere, no cameras, just you in the car, where what are you driving and where are you going?
I am going to drive. I'm going to drive a 2.7 RS because I've never driven one. But I have been in one. I've been in the passenger seat, and everything I know, so from the people I trust, I think it would be. I love the idea of a 2.7 RS daily beta. I think that would be good. So maybe a little bit of light rally sort of prep in there as well, just to kind of spice it up a bit.
Oh yeah.
Then where am I driving it? It's going to be Scotland because I love Scotland.
Nice.
And as I said, I went to university there, and I always just feel I love the rough and tumble nature of UK roads is, I'm sure the bane of many a chassis engineer's life, but when they make it work, and Porsche by and large does seem to make it work, it makes the roads so interesting and gives you something to do. There's that little bit of a rally stage in there, so maybe it would be the road up through the Cairngorms, the sort of the old military road, which I still love, and it's so yeah 2.7 RS up in Scotland. That's my choice.
Nice.
That sounds pretty good. Hey James, what about you? Turbo S straight to Chipotle?
Pretty much, yeah. Give me one of my straight roads in Minnesota, and get me to McDonald's as quickly as possible.
That whole question was just that it's literally, you don't care about my answer at all.
It was just a setup. It was all a setup.
Teed it up just to be able to deliver that line to James, wasn't it? That was, nice, fair play. Nicely done. Here's me instead of thinking, I'll put a load of effort in. Wow, picked well with a car. Oh, yeah, road. Thank goodness I remember Scotland. Fantastic. Oh, you're sitting in the seat. He's going to stop in a minute, and then I'm just going to be able to deliver the line. Here we are.
You
Hold on, Henry. I'm not going to sit here and take that. I'm not even because actually that.
Oh, what's that? No, the line's question. Are we going to have to stop this?
that question actually came. He's going to hate me for doing this, but it came from my friend Anthony. He said, "I said you got anything you want me to ask?" And he couldn't think of anything. And I said, "Oh, what about if you just say Anthony says hi, and Henry give him a shout out?"
Hi, Anthony.
But then he said, ask him favourite road, favourite car. So there you go. Oh, fantastic. Well, Henry, what an honour having you on the pod. Thank you for bringing a little bit of sophistication to an otherwise knuckleheaded pod that we run here at Curb and Canyon. It's been incredible.
There we go. Can I recommend a film of the week?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, please.
Or film of the pod or whatever. So it's actually one, it's slightly easier, I feel, but it's not one of mine, so I feel I can say it, but it's on the Haggerty YouTube channel that they did the Porsche Le Mans film. It's about 45 minutes long, and my friend over in the US, Matt Ticillo, did it. And it is, if you haven't seen it, kind of, you might have mentioned it before. If you have, I'm sorry. I kind of,
No, we haven't.
But yeah, it's really, really good. I sat there and thoroughly enjoyed that, so yeah, I'd heartily recommend it.
All right, give it a go.
Yeah, agreed. It's beautifully done. You heard it here first, people. The Le Mans film that Haggerty did. It is. It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
There's lots of nice interviews, aren't there? I think that are kind of lots of nice people chats. It's good. Okay.
Yeah, it is brilliant. It is brilliant. Well, Henry, we'll let you go and get on with your day. Again, thank you so much for joining us here on Curb and Canyon. It's been an absolute pleasure. And if you're ever down in Australia, look us up. Come driving with us.
I will do.
Or if you're in Minnesota.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cheers, Henry. Thank you.
It's been great fun. Thank you very much, guys. Thank you.
What was that? That thing about meeting your heroes and that whole thing. He was exactly as I thought he would be.
Yeah, yeah. Very genuine. I just, what a career, 20 years, the story, you know, going back to university years and interning and, you know, trying to really make it happen for himself. And the magazines, the cars, the people, the everything that he's done. Wow, what a fantastic career. And just what a really nice, genuine fella. Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, same. And it's funny, isn't it? You think about all the work he's put into making that happen, and you know, then you got people like us who just put a camera in front of ourselves and say, "Hey, Ken, welcome to."
Hey, speak for yourself, son.
Well, anyway, that was a massive treat. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to Henry as much as we enjoyed chatting with him. That was, that was a great experience. You know what, James? That's one of the great things about this pod. You know, like I was thinking about this the other day. It was, you know, you and me have never met yet. You're a really great mate. You know, it's just been something that's, yeah, it's brilliant. I love it. And through it, you know, you meet these people that you wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity to connect with. Just awesome. Awesome.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you guys all for listening. As always, we genuinely appreciate it. Thanks for all the comments on Insta and the DMs and the like. It's unreal. Please, if you're not already, follow us, Curb and Canyon on Instagram, James Auto Amateur on Instagram and YouTube, and me, Andy Last Rasp on Instagram and YouTube. I think that's all the handles we need to mention, no?
Yeah, maybe. Joey Tribbiani at total911.com. I don't know.
Well, actually, obviously follow Henry Catchpole on Instagram, and then Haggerty on YouTube. He's not doing the car fiction stuff anymore. But if you haven't checked out his films, obviously please do that. And we will also link to Henry's suggested video of the week. Okay, how's that? He did a video of the week.
I love it. Yeah, just totally jumping in with both feet. That's awesome. All right, guys, we'll see you in another pod soon.
See you, gang.